maternal grandmother as administrator of the estate of GB, a deceased minor and maternal grandmother individually, versus Hamilton County Department of Job and Family Services, Hamilton County, Ohio, Denise Driehouse, Chris Monzel, Todd Portoon, Shamira Stevens, AKA Shamira Hooks Ware, Cassie Setti, and Lamadi Lavusa, and father of GB and mother of GB. For the appellant, Mr. Robinson.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time. 2-year-old Glenara Bates was tortured and murdered by her own parents. Those parents have been and will be held criminally accountable. But this appeal is about whether there will ever be any chance to hold the caseworkers, the family services caseworkers assigned to Glenara, responsible for wantonly and recklessly failing to do anything to stop her torture and murder. More specifically, this case is about whether plaintiffs will ever have the opportunity to conduct any discovery, to take any depositions, to look at any internal family services documents to determine whether Glenara was, excuse me, rather, how it was that the caseworkers failed Glenara. The trial court answered these questions. Should discovery occur? Should these caseworkers ever be held accountable? With emphatic no's. The Court of Appeals affirmed in a 2-1 decision. The Court of Appeals purported to apply Ohio's well-established notice pleading standards, but review of the analysis of that opinion makes it clear that instead the majority of the court subjected plaintiffs to a heightened standard of review. But there can be no question here that if the proper standard had been applied, the standard that this court and the lower courts have held time and time again should apply, the standard that this court made clear in New York always applies to governmental employee immunity cases, that this case would have survived the motion for judgment on the pleadings. The caseworkers here knew that Glenara's mother was an abuser before she was even born. Her mother had abused her 6 older children already, and all of them had been taken from her mother's care. Family services were present at the hospital the day that Glenara was born. They took her immediately from her mother's care. They knew how dangerous she was. 8 months later, a juvenile court returned Glenara to her mother. And 3 months after that, in December of 2013, even though Glenara's father, Glenn, had failed to ever comply with family services directives, family services terminated its supervision of the case. Then tragically, a year after that, in December of 2014, December 4th, 2014, Glenara was taken to the hospital, Cincinnati Children's, nearly 2 years old, a month from her second birthday. She was unable to walk. She was unable to stand without support. She presented with flat affect. She had severe developmental delays. The medical records attached to the complaint make it clear that she also suffered from hair loss and that she was diagnosed with likely bilateral atelectasis, in other words, bilateral collapsed lung. Most shockingly, when she was born, Glenara was in the 90th percentile for weight and the 98th percentile for height. When she was taken to the hospital a month shy of her second birthday, she weighed 17 pounds. She was in the 0.16 percentile for weight, the 0.07 percentile for height. And regarding head circumference, the medical records simply say she was in zero percentile. Even in the hospital, malnourished, famished, she wouldn't eat. She would not eat when presented with food until given affirmative permission by her mother. And her mother admitted to the hospital staff that she had intentionally withheld food from Glenara from the day that she first got custody of her a little over a year before that. The signs of abuse were blatant and obvious. So hospital staff contacted family services. Family services supposedly made one visit while Glenara was in the hospital, but she was admitted for 11 days. During that 11-day period, there is no evidence that they did anything other than a single visit, no evidence of any follow-up, no evidence of any safety plan, no evidence of any intent to remove her from her parents or to conduct follow-on visits. Fast forward then, Glenara is discharged 11 days later on December 15th, 2014, 3 months after that, on March 4th, 2015, for the very first time, Family Services conducts a home visit to Glenara. So we know she had all of these problems when she was in the hospital. At that home visit, she is pronounced happy and healthy, and the case is essentially closed. 3.5 weeks later, she's dead. She was tortured and murdered by her parents. The medical examiner said that her cause of death was battered child syndrome with acute and chronic intracranial hemorrhages and starvation, listed the onset of as months. And the coroner found that little Glenara had been abused, quote, her entire pathetically short life. She was covered with over 100 wounds, bruises.
Excuse me, counselor.
Yes.
But when she was in the hospital for 11 days, there was no indications of physical abuse, were there? The doctors didn't report anything.
There were no indications of scarring or bruising of physical marks on her body. That's right. We would submit that forced starvation is indeed a form of physical abuse. But no, there were not at that time scars or bruises, whip marks, bite marks reported in the record. But we have to remember that there was a 3-month gap there. And according to the coroner, sometime over those quote months, those wounds were inflicted. We know there were scars. So we know that the wounds were not just inflicted in the 3-month period between that visit and her death. We know that the wounds numbered in the hundreds. So you are absolutely right, Justice DeWine, that there was nothing in the medical records in December showing that the bruising and the scars were present, but they certainly were present in that period between the discharge and the visit from the social workers. So we would submit that this case is really very straightforward. There isn't a universe in which family services workers could do a home visit, could find a child was happy and healthy, given all of these facts, without acting wantonly and or recklessly. So one of three things happened. Either they didn't do the home visit and just lied, said they did. They did do the visit, but lied about the outcome because they didn't want the trouble of another case, or they were so wanton and reckless that they missed these signs. They missed the signs of a bruised, tortured, scarred child who weighed somewhere at that point between 13 and 17 pounds. She was 13 pounds when she died. That they missed all of those signs. And we would submit that if this case can't survive a motion for judgment on the pleadings, that no case can. This court, as I think I had mentioned already, was very clear in New York that notice pleading standards apply to governmental employee immunity cases. That decision is 30 years old now, has never been challenged. The courts of appeals in the state are unanimous that the notice pleading applies here, with the only exception being the 2-1 majority in this particular case. As you are all aware, the court has from time to time in the past said that in very limited circumstances, heightened pleading is appropriate. For instance, in situation of intentional employer torts or of negligent hiring in the religious context. But those are very limited circumstances that have, this court has said, have profound public policy reasons for those special rules. And they certainly have no application to this case. And I would point out as well that those cases too are roughly 30 years old. So it's been 30 years since this court has extended heightened pleading requirements beyond that very narrow subset of cases. And this certainly wouldn't be the case to extend it any further. Now, my colleagues observed in their brief, they took a very inconsistent view of exactly what should be pled and what was pled. First, that brief said that plaintiff, that Mrs. Bradley, had not been subjected to a heightened pleading standard but instead failed to just show a nexus between the injuries that were investigated and those from which Glenara died. Then the brief goes on to state that the heightened pleading was required and that plaintiff was required to include facts, quote, beyond the operative facts of what occurred and must plead heightened intent. Now heightened intent isn't recognized, as far as I know, in the law of Ohio. Even under Rule 9B, the heightened pleading requirement for fraud, that rule is explicit that malice, intent, and other state of mind may still be averred generally. But our opponents go on to assert that animus should be required here. As we state in our brief, there's simply no basis for that in law, no policy basis for that as well. Finally, they conclude by urging the court to adopt the Twombly standard in this case, and presumably in all civil cases. Well, this court has had numerous opportunities to do that in the past and has repeatedly declined. At least as recently as 2015, the court said no thank you to that in Wells Fargo v. Horn. At that point, Twombly was already 8 years old.
Mr. Robinson, I don't believe that the other side argued Twombly in the appellate court, did they?
That's correct, Jim. They did not. But the other thing to mention about Twombly is that, ironically, after asking for Twombly, my opponents say at page 28 of their brief that the facts as pled show that it is, quote, at least equally possible that defendants acted properly here. So they're saying it's a 50-50 chance. Twombly says we need merely reach a plausibility standard, that we don't have to show probability, but mere plausibility. So even on our opponent's own standards, we have satisfied. I see that my time is going quickly, so I'd like to reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel? Ms. Sears?
Pardon me, Your Honor. Thank you very much. May it please the court and Justice O'Connor, thank you very much. This case presents as a combination of Rule 12C, which is inextricably intertwined with 2744.03A6B. If you'll pardon me, I'll just say 6B from now on going forward. That's best illustrated by the fact that recklessness, Your Honors, is a question of degree of breach. Since recklessness is a consequence of a degree of breach, then it is axiomatic that in order for the case to move forward at all, there needs to be a determination by the court that there is a cognizable private right of interest at play. In fact, I would submit for the court to go forward to the consideration of whether the facts are sufficient to ban the benefit of immunity at the pleading stage. Before the court gets to an examination of the sufficiency of those facts, there needs to be a determination of a cognizable right of interest. And I draw the court's attention to this court's decision in Graves, where I think the court made clear that in order to even delve into whether or not facts are sufficient to move the case into the discovery phase when 6B is implicated, there needs to be a determination that the statute at play, if there is a statute, or I would suggest to the court, absent a statute, then traditional court, tort concepts of duty suggest a cognizable private right of action. In their reply brief, appellants assert, for the first time, we are bringing up duty. I went back and reread the memorandum in opposition to the motion to amend the complaint. I went back and read our pleading with regard to our motion to dismiss the complaint. And in my mind, I went back to pre-litigation conversations with trial counsel. Throughout has been my concern is that my client, JFS, and these caseworkers did not have legal custody of this child. There is no general duty in Ohio to protect someone over whom you do not have control, or protect from that person from someone over whom you do not have control. Make no mistake that this case is not simply about Rule 12C. This case is not simply about Iqbal Twombly and whether this court would expand Rule 8 to incorporate plausibility. This case is not even necessarily about heightened intent, primarily from our perspective. It is about whether or not in Ohio there is a general duty to protect children over whom you do not have custody against persons over whom you do not have control. That has never been established before, and this case, if not, if reversed, will set that precedent. With regard to the, I think, can I say that appellant's counsel misapprehend the argument in the brief? I made the case for Iqbal Twombly. That's certainly up to the court. Court hasn't been willing to go that far or found the necessity to enlarge Rule 8's traditional Ohio concepts to incorporate plausibility. It's nevertheless apparent when one surveys the panoramic view of the of your inferior courts that your courts in fact are adopting to a degree plausibility. And I find it, I would find it odd if anyone could argue that, for example, in Maine versus, I think it was Cipollone versus Hoffmeyer below, the court said, you know, we're not going to incorporate wishful thinking into Rule 8. In Toledo, which we relied on at the trial level and also at the appellate level, the court said ease of entry that exists as a result of Rule 8 and Ohio's application traditionally of no set of facts entitling you to relief. Certainly
excuse me.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
This whole the Twombly conversation to me seems beside the point. I mean, this is about Twombly is really about plausibility. It's about right. whether or not a set of facts is plausible. But that's not really the issue here, is it? I mean, I think no one disagrees that their claim is plausible, that that there was a failure to know what was going on here. But the real issue here is the specificity with which allegations need to be made. That's not really a Twombly issue, is it? I mean, Twombly wouldn't change anything here, would it?
Well, I understand what you're saying. I don't know that I wholeheartedly agree, but I do very much appreciate what you're saying. What I see when I survey your inferior courts and the filter or the analysis that they bring to the question of whether the case sounds in negligence or whether it sounds in something beyond negligence so that the benefit of immunity would not apply at the pleading stage, I see the lower courts incorporating not only the Rule 8 standard, but infusing it in a way that, frankly, I don't find offensive with considerations of plausibility. By that, I mean mere speculation, conclusory legal statements that aren't supported by facts, wishful thinking. So when we were looking at this case and considering plausibility, Justice DeWine, that's what was in our mind, that incorporating those concepts into our traditional analysis under Rule 8 is not offensive to Rule 8. It doesn't remove us from the traditional parameters of Rule 8, and a survey of your inferior courts will reflect that the lower courts are infusing their Rule 8 analyses with plausibility. But to your question,
why does the York case not control in this particular case?
In what fashion? If you mean in terms of York saying there's no heightened pleading standard, I think York
right.
is absolutely controlling. It's absolutely controlling as we all sit here having this conversation. I noticed in York that the court was critical of the position in York because there wasn't a public policy suggested by the defendants in that case for supporting heightened pleading standard. When I looked at 2151, I should say when we did, I could see a public policy that would support a heightened pleading standard, but I have to agree with you. I don't know that a heightened pleading standard, in fact, I would suggest to you, is not necessary in this case to resolve the case in our favor. And I guess that's my response to appellant counsel's characterization of the brief. It misapprehends the arguments. The court accepted this case. This case is a case that stresses and points out the tension between the application of 12C under Rule 8 and 2744-03A6B. And in that regard, there are any number of approaches the court could take. And what we sought in our brief was to elucidate what those were. Frankly, the manner in which the lower courts in the state are applying that filter, applying that analysis, using what in David versus Matter, the court described as a heightened intent standard, really reflects what the court did in DiGiorgio, reflects what the court did in Toledo, and with all due respect, reflects what the court did in the case that Justice Stewart sat on, Bowman versus Downs, as well as Ameren versus Tell, as well as David versus Matter. In all of those cases, the court did not look to what the plaintiff pled the case as? Did you plead it as negligence? Did you use the magic words of recklessness, et cetera? No, the court looked at what were the facts alleged in the complaint and were they sufficient to move the case beyond one that sounded in tort? And that's why I think in this case, it's elucidating to look at the actual complaint in this case.
I wanted to get to that point, but I want to, this is Justice Bruner here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Justice Bruner. It's a little, it's hard to tell whose lips are moving sometimes. I apologize.
No worries. So how would, getting to the complaint, how would this case or your argument or your issues about public policy be different if, there was a credible source that contacted Children's Services, which was a hospital,
but how
would it be different if the agency had no prior contact with this family? How would it be different if the agency had not taken this child away from its mother at birth and been aware of the history of family violence and abuse and neglect?
So that's a very interesting observation. And I have given that great thought because one of the things that has been problematic and troublesome is the structure of 2151, the chapter, as well as 5153, which are the obligations and duties of JFS in this context. Clearly manage or attempt to the tension between what this court has described Justice Lanziger and O'Toole as the basic and essential right to raise your children versus obviously the overwhelming effort on behalf of government to intervene when you are doing so in a way that causes the child harm. And so in this particular scenario, for example, the juvenile court gave the children back, reinstituted custody. Protective services was terminated, not only at the recommendation of our client, JFS, but also at the recommendation of the guardian ad litem, who represented the interest of the children individually, who are plaintiffs in this action. And that's apparent from the pleadings and the public records attached to the pleadings. So,
as a matter of granting a motion for judgment on the pleadings, if the only thing that had happened was that the hospital called Children's Services out of the blue, there'd been no prior contact, and then the same result ended up, does that affect the duty or the relationship between the parties in terms of whether or not the trial court could grant a motion for judgment on the pleadings?
Well, two things. One, had there been some report at the time of the hospitalization of physical abuse, which in fact was the prior report and was substantiated and why the children were taken away from this mother initially, then I could see an argument, Your Honor, that yes, there would be some argument that there was some sort of knowledge that would infuse this analysis. The fact is that is not the case in here, that there was no allegation of physical abuse and there had been no allegations of starvation and that kind of thing before in the known to the agency, at least from the pleadings, we'll say.
But counsel, let me stop you there. The child presented at the hospital, initially they called CSB, right?
Yes, ma'am. Their mandatory reporter, yes, ma'am.
All right, what triggered that mandatory report?
A concern on the part of the hospital that this was a case of neglect, either socially caused or organically caused. As the child was admitted into the hospital, the medical professionals were not sure. As the child was released from the hospital, according to paragraph 24 of the complaint, the doctor at the hospital ascribed the failure to thrive to three things: a lack of medical care, financial hardship, and lack of family support. Interestingly, when you look at the medical records that are attached to the pleading, this is what you see. The mother voluntarily brought her child to the hospital. According to the medical records, from the time that she regained custody of the child to approximately 14 months, she brought the child to the emergency room on at least three or four separate occasions. When you look at the medical records, it's apparent, at least it says in the medical records, that she ran into a problem with insurance. And so that the last ED visit before this one she engaged in, there was a problem with her insurance. I don't think anyone would suggest that because someone has problems, they have financial hardships, that we should remove their children from them. I don't think anyone would suggest that because someone has a lack of familial support, that we should remove their children from them. And I don't think anybody would suggest that because someone, because of their financial hardships, finds it difficult sometimes to get medical treatment, that we should take their children from them. Well, but that is what the medical records say. Medical record, I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
So the fact that this baby needed to be in the hospital for 11 days as a result of the condition that she was in when presented to the hospital, no matter whether it was they were, you know, financially stressed, they didn't have, you know, family support, but there was no doubt about her malnutrition and her physical condition.
That's correct. And the reason she was in the hospital for 11 days was for the hospital to rule out an organic cause of failure to thrive. The other thing the hospital records clearly indicate is that her caregivers were present at the time the hospital expressed to them what the issues were and what the appropriate response going forward would be to rectify the situation. And the hospital records attached to the complaint say the caregivers were responsive to that.
Okay, so basically what the instructions were, you've got to do a better job and here's how you do it. That was given, that was the instruction to the parents. Correct?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, we're tied to what's attached to the complaint. So what we do know from the complaint is that the caregiver was present and was responsive. What the complaint alleges is the failure to intervene and allow the child to be discharged to her mother is the factual nexus to the her ultimate murder and also the failing that presents liability for JFS. Also, the failure then to remove the child. The complaint actually reads in paragraph 38, had the continuing abuse been reported, Janera Bates, the child, would not have been in the home in order to be killed. If you read paragraph 38, 37, and paragraph 2, what will become apparent is what was alleged in this case was a failure to report the continuing abuse to law enforcement creates liability. And this court has been very specific and adamant that there's no cross duty to report. I see that my time is running down, Your Honors. What I would suggest is that a reversal of this case will establish in the state of Ohio a general duty to protect children for whom someone does not have custody from the actions of a third party over whom the person has no control. And I would also caution, as the court has cautioned, that the tragedy of this death is apparent. That fact cannot enter into a reasoned application of the law and determination what the law is in the state of Ohio. And that was your caution in O'Toole, and that is the caution in DeShaney. And yes, I'm sorry.
It's Justice Bruner again.
Oh, thank you. I'm so sorry.
So you said that the allegations in the complaint in terms of what basically Children's Services did wrong were the release of the child to the mother, and the failure to report continuing abuse to law enforcement. Anything else?
The paragraph in paragraph 38 says, 37, failure to report, quote, let alone remove, close quote. There are other allegations in paragraph 37 that center around the judicial court's return of the child, which I think have been sort of winnowed out as the case has promulgated or sort of percolated up to you guys. But at this point, I think all that's left is the allegation that there was a failure to prevent discharge from the hospital to the custody of the mother, and then failure to report the continuing abuse, which allowed the child to remain in the home in order that she was present to be killed by her father.
Counsel, what about the home visit? How do you see that? The home visit where there was clearly a report made that did not comport with the condition of the child.
So my issue with that, Your Honor, is this. That argument is based on an autopsy that was done about 3 weeks after the child was seen by the caseworker. In that autopsy, as the court well knows, having, I think, presided over the death penalty case, there were reports of the abuse to the child. What is missing from this complaint, frankly, is to what extent those injuries may have been or should have been apparent. Certainly the caseworker, who is not a nurse and is not conducting an autopsy, cannot see healing fractures. Interestingly, at the hospital in December, the doctors noted that the problem walking preceded the problem with nutrition, yet the hospital didn't do a skeletal scan. Had the hospital done a skeletal scan in December and suggested, as Justice Bruner suggests, that there were some kind of physical issues, we might be having a different conversation. With regard to that visit, I believe the problem there is an inference upon an inference. So you're inferring that certain injuries, which you don't identify in the complaint, in fact, this isn't really well pled in the complaint at all. This is more of a function of motion practice after the complaint. But you don't plead which of those injuries should have been or were apparent. You then infer that because certain injuries should have or could have been or likely were apparent, that the caseworker either saw them and didn't do anything about it, or in fact lied and didn't go there. This is an inference upon an inference. And it's well settled that you can have multiple inferences from a set of facts, but what is impermissible is to have an inference upon an inference. And I think that is the legal problem with that argument, Your Honor.
Isn't there a duty of any children's services to identify when a child is in danger? Isn't that kind of a public duty? Isn't that why the agency, one of the reasons the agencies exist?
So I would agree with you that certainly investigating the possibility or the report of suspected abuse and neglect is a function of the agency. I would absolutely agree with you. My issue is, as the court went in O'Toole, noted the three separate sort of categories of when that duty realizes itself, okay? In the emergency removal of a child, as the Grimm case suggested to the court in O'Toole, in the protective services or protected services scenario where the court has ordered the agency to provide protective services, which is the case in Jackson, in which the court found not that there was no recklessness. And then lastly, the case in Hahn, where the agency had custody of the child. It was a foster situation. I don't think there's any doubt that we're, to the extent the agency has custody or the extent that the agency has control, that there's a duty to protect. But where the agency is investigating potential abuse and neglect, although there is a duty to investigate, I don't think that the statute then parlays that into a duty, a general duty to protect during that investigation.
So is there ever a duty?
Also, there's a mandatory duty to report, but no duty to do anything about it.
Well, this court has held that there's no liability for a failure to investigate, which also brings an interesting question. If there's no duty for a failure, if there's no duty to investigate for which there's liability, then the question becomes: if you undertake a investigation, how is there a duty created? The General Assembly has not suggested that there is a mandate for a particular mandate that is the conclusion of an investigation. The agency can sustain abuse and not remove children. The agency can sustain neglect and not remove children. So there is no duty to remove. There's no duty to take custody of children. There is a duty, Justice Brenner, I would wholeheartedly agree, for the agency to investigate. And one of my concerns is
what about to report a crime? It has a duty to report crimes if it observes them in its investigation, correct?
There is no duty to cross-report from the agency to law enforcement. The agency is the agency to whom abuse and neglect is reported. So I have had cases when I was prosecuting criminal cases where there were child endangering that we were engaging in prosecuting an individual on, where law enforcement was not involved, and some where they were. So you are correct. There are times when there is a report. Generally speaking, in my experience, that report starts out as a crime that then law enforcement reports to the agency, and then the agency conducts their investigation, has been my experience, as opposed to at the agency receiving a report of abuse and neglect, investigating it, reporting to law enforcement, with the potential exception, I suppose, of a sexual offense.
That's probably what was the impetus for Franklin County to kind of combine everything into one center, where prosecutors, child enforcement agencies, and the hospital at Nationwide Children's Hospital actually kind of come together with an integrated, comprehensive approach. That's not available in Cincinnati, correct?
No, actually, we have a Meyerson Center here, Your Honor, which is exactly that, where we have a concentrated approach involving medical, social services, as well as law enforcement when a crime is implicated. So we have that ability here, and that does happen. And I didn't mean to suggest that it didn't happen. I just don't, in my experience, necessarily believe that every abuse and neglect that's reported to the agency translates into a criminal matter. Although it certainly is true that that can be the case and does in fact happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. With the court and the clock's indulgence, I'd like to run through four or five different points quickly if I could. First, counsel asserts that this case is about duty. The court has made clear in Argabright and in Cleveland versus Moore that whether a governmental employee is entitled to immunity is a separate question entirely from whether the elements of the underlying claim have been established. They're totally separate inquiries. Counsel asserts that they have preserved the duty argument because they raised it, quote, in their motion opposing, or rather the brief opposing the motion to amend the complaint. What she doesn't say is that it was raised in their motion for judgment on the pleadings or in the Court of Appeals. So that argument has in fact been abandoned. But as stated, it is meritless regardless because the court has made clear that duty and immunity are totally separate inquiries. Next, regarding the assertion that the court has held that there's no—
Mr. Robinson, I think what your opposing counsel was saying was that you don't even get into immunity if there's no such duty. Is that what, so, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, we would deal with that here in a couple of ways. First, that wasn't argued in the motion for judgment on the pleading, so it's not before the court. Second, the court has said that the threshold issue is the immunity issue. It's not the underlying duty issue, you know, if there's duty breach, cause and fact, damages, you know, whether the underlying claim is properly pled. The first issue, the threshold issue, is immunity, and that is the issue that the court granted on. Next, regarding the
counsel, just for purposes, I'm kind of rehashing what opposing counsel said. This child was identified, if not abused, neglected by the hospital record several weeks before she died, correct?
That's correct. Several months, Your Honor.
Several months before she died. Okay. And then that obligated CSB to investigate and continue with the case. Am I right?
That's right. That obligated Family Services to start an investigation. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so the investigation, I mean, they have a case involving this child. From what, upon the discharge of the hospital, I think the record reflects they went to the home once. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, 3 months later.
And that's the level of their investigation.
That's right, which is contrary both to statute and to the Ohio Administrative Code. So 2151.421 F and G require the investigation, require that it occur within 24 hours after the report. So we know that the report happened at the beginning of this stay. So presumably second day of the stay, they started their quote unquote investigation. Now the administrative code 5101 says that they're required at that juncture to fill out the JFS form 1401. That form has a number of questions that they have to answer. And in the end, they have to reach one of four conclusions. This is really helpfully set forth in our amicus brief from the Justice for Children Clinic. But they have to say either that the child will be taken out. There are two different mechanisms for taking the child out of the home. They have to say that the child is safe, which means either there is no threat to safety or that the family is keeping the child safe from the threat, or they can allow the child to stay in the custody of the parents, but they must conduct weekly visits thereafter. That's clear from Administrative Code 5101:2-37-02. I think it's part G of that, but it's clear that they have to do weekly visits. And there's no question here that according to the complaint, those absolutely did not occur here. Regarding the financial hardship inquiry, the record makes clear that in fact, the issue here was not financial hardship, but that the mother did not want to feed the child. She thought she was overweight. Regarding the idea that she was kept in the hospital for those 11 days because they wanted to tell if it was a social or counsel said organic cause, that's incorrect. That's not supported by the medical record or the complaint. Rather, she was kept in, presumably the inference is to wait to see if family services would actually get anything done and to see if they could get her above a starvation level weight. The inquiry is sociological versus biological factors, and the medical record makes clear that biologically caused failure to thrive was ruled out immediately. It was sociological, and that is a politically correct way of saying that her parents were starving her. I see that my time is well past expired, so I would urge the court to reverse to stem the tide of a decision that is an anomaly and that could cause so much damage down the road. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, counsel, and you'll be notified of our decision.